This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, the Souls Harbor Rescue Mission is ringing the dinner bell for a nutritious meal on Christmas Eve, and if you're hungry again on Boxing Day, you'll find another hot meal not far from there. There's some tension behind the scenes of a popular Cape Breton music festival. We'll hear from one of the people involved with Celtic Colors. We'll revisit a Lewisburg artist who's mixing ancient techniques with modern tools, and a professor has penned a touching tribute to his late wife and his son. These stories are coming up on the Coast. An attempt to dismiss the board of directors for the Celtic Colors International Festival is being challenged. Recently, members of the Celtic Colors Festival Society held a meeting where they voted to dismiss the current board of directors. However, board chair Marcel McCaw says the vote is invalid because it didn't comply with the society's bylaws. He speaks to Dialogue's Jacob Postlewaite.
Yeah, so I guess just first, in your own words, tell us what happened.
Okay, well, before I do that, can I just sort of lay out the, you know, the technical elements of it?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so Celtic Colors is a society based, you know, based in Cape Breton sort of thing, and they have currently we have 83 members, and to be a member of the society, you have to apply. The board accepts you. You pay $25, and you're a member for life. Right? Okay. That's how it works.
Right.
And every year the society can bring in new members and wants. It doesn't get a whole lot of new members over time. It usually has like a steady sort of enrollment of members. And so in our bylaws, it states that if a group of members, it has to be 25% of the membership, would like to call an extraordinary meeting, they asked the board of directors to do that. So a group did indeed send us a petition, if you will. Not a petition, but they requisitioned us, or they petitioned us, whatever. And they asked that this meeting be held. And so the board, coincidentally, was meeting just a few days after that. So the board after that met and basically said, yeah, let's meet with them, no problem. And we had a little bit of a sense of what their concerns were, because some of them were at the annual general meeting back in April. And after that meeting in April, we'd had multiple discussions with them. And, you know, we had a meeting with them, and then we sort of exchanged emails back and forth over the summer and up to this year's festival. So they wanted this meeting called. The board agreed that it would. And I contacted the leaders of that group personally, which is Dr. Scott and Gerardette Brown, and proposed that we do that in early January. But they didn't like that idea. They preferred instead to meet a week later, on December 7th. So the problem with that, though, is that, and then they basically wrote to the members and they called a meeting for December 7th. But the problem with that is that this special meeting, you know, 25 members asked for a special meeting. The board said, okay, let's do that. They don't get to set the time and the location. Meetings of the society can only be called by the chair or the directors. And so, but nonetheless, they called the meeting. And on short notice, frankly, they don't have, under our bylaws, they don't have the right to call a meeting. The meeting has to be called by the chair and by the directors. I know I'm repeating myself, but I'm just trying to be clear on that point. So, and they were going ahead no matter what. So I notified them, said, like, guys, you're not entitled to call a meeting. It's not allowed in the bylaws. So they said, yeah, too bad. We're calling this meeting. It's December 7th. Now, the reason why we wanted more time was because a few people in this group are fastidious, and they are the type of people who are fussy about, you know, they would be sure to arrive in that meeting with all their everything lined up and ready to go. I felt that we should at least have the same opportunity, and That was one thing. The second, so we asked for more time for that purpose. The second reason was because in our office, we had recently, we just started the process to replace the artistic director, and we had another job, which we'd advertised for, and we had 30 applicants for, and we were getting ready to go through all of that. We're still wrapping up year end with the accountants. So when we, when we finish the festival, then we're going through a whole element of financial reckoning. Everybody who's involved with the festival in one way or another, we're sending our checks, we're dealing with a mail strike. There's just a lot going on at one time. And at the same time, are also beginning to regenerate all activities for next year's festival. So it was a busy time. And more importantly, the month of December, like there's 2 weeks lost because of Christmas, really. Like once you hit the middle of December, it's hard to get people to sort of focus on this type of stuff. So we recommended January 4th. They said, not good. We're going on December 7th. We said, you don't really have the right to call the meeting on December 7th. So they said, tough, we're going ahead. The problem with that is with our approval, they really couldn't call a meeting. So prior to the meeting, we felt we have to tell the other members that this meeting is not a sanctioned meeting. People have to know that. The board thing here is we're abiding by the bylaws. And these bylaws are bylaws that were written, years ago, and we adhere to them every year. Everything we do is based on what's in those bylaws. And so, but they just said basically that was not satisfactory to them. So unfortunately, they called the meeting, they made motions, they motioned to have us eliminated. So 30, there were 37 people at the meeting, but six of them were associated with the board, either former board members or board members. And so really there was 31 people there, that were really kind of interested in this whole option. So in the meeting, they put a motion on the floor, and the motion they voted to have us removed. The problem is they didn't have any authority in the meeting because the meeting was not an official meeting of the society. The meeting basically was a meeting of 31 people who had an interest in Celtic Colors, but no legal standing. So,
yeah. So how are you feeling about that then?
I'm discouraged, I'm not discouraged. I'm upset about it because I don't think the society needs this kind of disruption. I don't know if you follow Celtic Colors closely, but you know what? This year's festival is hugely successful. We had a lot of sold-out concerts, more than pretty much any other year that I'm aware of. Our box office is returning back to pre-COVID days. Like, it took a long time to sort of get it all back in gear. The shows I personally went to were fantastic. We did tributes to performers, and we had big crowds. And, frankly, the volunteers I spoke to were happy, and the festival had a real buzz about it. It was a really great festival. And financially, we haven't finished all the books yet. We're waiting for the accountants to do their thing. But right now, it would look like we're going to run a fair-sized surplus, which, that's hard to do. 3 years ago, when I first came to the board, we were running deficits. And, we don't have all kinds of money sort of sitting around to run deficits. So, but we were able to get through that. And we, last year we made about $1,200 and this year we're in much better shape even still. So, there's a whole lot of things that are working really well, and, all of a sudden they want us removed. It just feels so heavy handed, and it's just not recognizing the successes we've had. So it's frustrating.
Right. And you're kind of getting along the lines of what the next thing I was going to ask was, which was, how you felt about the concerns that those members brought forward.
Well, so we've been discussing those concerns since April, so we're somewhat familiar with them. There's two levels of concerns. First of all, they're concerned about change in staff, changeover in staff. So in the last 2 years, we have had five staff leave. That's true. And the second concern, is about volunteers and people sort of, you know, on the right at the front door of the festival, if you will. People who are, you know, parking cars, people who are working in the techno thing, you know, on the tech side, people who are, you know, serving meals, you name it. I mean, you name it, our volunteers tend to do it. They drive artists, they drive ticket holders, they, you know, they help the community in a lot of ways. So we have been working closely to provide more training for our volunteers. We provided a number of training sessions this year, and you know, we just tried to be closer to the community. We did a whole lot of work on venue liaison, which in the last couple of years, that sort of kind of, you know, during COVID, that kind of cooled. And this year, and that was the help with Joella Foles, who came in to help us. And basically, we did all kinds of work with venue liaison. So we were kind of we ramped up all of the communications we have with the various venues on all the various issues that they have to deal with us on. And we felt that, you know, we made real progress there. And with the staffing, like, you know, we're 28 years old. So, you know, there are some changes in staff occur. And, you know, sometimes some staff members, you know, it's just a few of them had job opportunities that they went to, which, to be fair, like, you know, we pay pretty good, but, you know, they found better opportunity. Change is inevitable with staff. So, you know, all I can say is nobody was, they all left on their own accord. And, you know, that's natural, right? There are a number of staff there right now, and we're replacing staff. I can tell you that one of the positions, the last position where the employee left, we ran, you know, job ads for that, and we've had great response. Like I said, 30 applications, and amongst those applications are some great people. And you know, and we're in the process of trying to hire. So I mean, right now I sort of feel like, you know, we will find new employees, and you know, they'll come into the game, they'll learn quickly. It's a vibrant project and a vibrant atmosphere, and I'm just optimistic that we can move on fairly quickly. So, and, you know.
Yeah, so I guess the last thing I'd want to ask is, like you were saying, just, you know, what are those next steps? What's the next thing you guys are going to be doing?
You know what, Jacob, thanks for asking that, because that is the most important element to all of this. We were requisitioned by 25 people. We want a meeting, and we are obligated to hold it, and no problem, we're going to hold it. We haven't set the date yet, but it will be fairly early in January, I can tell you that. And members will be notified that in a few days, and that meeting will be a meeting of the entire society. It'll be a closed door meeting, but it will be, those attending will be the number of members we've got right now. And, we expect that we'll have a great attendance, and I'm certain motions will be made, and I'm certain the board will have motions. And we'll probably provide a backgrounder on, you know, these are the things that have been occurring. Like, we've been treated unfairly here, because these people stood up and sort of said, well, it was this, and it was this, and it was this, and it was this, and it was this. And then they had a vote. There was no opportunity for the board of directors to stand up, because we didn't recognize the meeting, right? But they were giving us no opportunity in the planning of the meeting to stand up and say, well, this is what we've done. We did this, and we did this, we did this, we did that. And I think it was unfairly portrayed in the public's eye. So we're looking for that opportunity on January 4th to stand up and say, here's what we can tell you about what we've been doing. I will tell you this. We have an amazing board of directors. Like, the people on this board, if you look at their credentials, you know, there's some really, you know, capable individuals with a lot of relevant experience. And it's not like we're a bunch of slackers. So I take real, you know, it's frustrating when I hear people speak about it who don't know these people, who dismiss them quickly. Like, this is one of the better boards I've ever worked with, and I've, I have a long career in the cultural sector, and I can tell you I worked with a lot of big boards, and this one is one of the best. And it's just upsetting that this caliber of volunteer is being dismissed. It's just not fair. I'll also say, I just said the word there, volunteer, because a lot of these people say they're volunteers, but guess what? We are all volunteers too. there's nobody on our board receiving honorariums. There's nobody on our board. We don't get anything. If we have a meeting and it's in rural Cape Breton and we feel like, accommodations are needed, we'll provide hotel rooms. That's the extent of it. But generally speaking, there's nobody, these are 100% volunteer. So I don't know. Is that how you treat people who volunteer their time and their expertise willingly? I'm sorry, Jacob.
No, it's all good. It's all good. It's all good to hear. It's good to get, your perspective on it and the perspective of the board. So as far as like the meeting that just happened, I get the sense of you're just kind of ignoring that and have the full meeting in January.
That's exactly right. That's okay. The synopsis of it. I'll just tell you this though. I want you to know that we didn't just do this willy nilly. As soon as I'd had the conversation, they said, work on that meeting for December 7th. So we have a board, we have a lawyer who is close to our board and we consult with them on a regular basis. So I said, look, I'm looking at these bylaws here. They can't call a meeting. Can they call a meeting? And the lawyer said, no, they can't call a meeting, and sort of went through it with me. Said, here's how it works, blah, 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 blah. A former chair of the society is also a lawyer who sent me a note and said to me, you're on the right track. Your interpretation is correct. They do not have the right to call this meeting. And then, we've also pursued, we've been having discussions with the province of Nova Scotia who have reaffirmed this for us. We've been talking to an expert in the field of not-for-profit societies who's also giving us the same opinion. So we are, it's not that we're dismissing them. What it is they did not have the authority. And I guess the thing here is this. In the meeting, this was mentioned. Like, how do you respond to that? Dr. Scott was asked the question. And they said, the Societies Act governs this. But if you look carefully at the Societies Act, says that societies need to set up terms, bylaws, and then they are managed by the bylaws. So these bylaws that we're setting up, or these bylaws that we're abiding by, they were set not by our board, but by previous boards. And a few of those people who are in the camp, they were part of those boards. So we're using the bylaws that were written by our predecessors to a T. And now they don't like it and they just want to change it and do whatever they want. It's not fair. If we have to live by the bylaws, they have to live by the bylaws. And no matter how we go forward, every element we've got going on here, we're going to do it by the book fairly.
All right, then. Well, I think you covered everything I was looking to find out. So thanks so much, Marcel.
Thanks. Thank you, Jacob. It's great talking to you. I really appreciate your time tonight.
Northside drop-in centers are dealing with an unfortunate trend this Christmas. People aren't asking for regular presents. They're hoping the holidays will cover their basic needs. Organizers at the Clifford Street Youth Center in North Sydney and the J Street Youth Center in City Mines are getting requests for personal hygiene products and bedding for Christmas because their parents can't afford them. Souls Harbor Rescue Mission Manager Alana McClellan says their drop-in center has the same problem.
My goodness, we get calls. I get calls every single day now. from families in need, receiving a lot of phone calls from single mothers, and it's already been very difficult. It's cold now, and so now there's heating costs and cost of oil and people that aren't able to fill their oil tanks. And moms are crying because they don't have anything to give their children. And, you know, like the requests that I'm receiving, it's not for like an abundance of toys or wants. It's like teenage girls asking for body wash and for children, for young boys, jogging pants and like hooded sweatshirts, really like asking for basic coverage of needs. Yeah.
Meanwhile, their cook, Scott Anderson, says they are proud at the drop-in center to provide relief for people who are struggling to make ends meet.
It comes as a relief, a sense of accomplishment that if that is the case, that people can forget a little bit for that they're maybe couch surfing or living in a tent, that here they're warm, they're greeted with a friendliness, an openness, and a sense of peace that they might not find in other situations that they're living in, whatever that may be, that then that's a good thing. And we have been blessed, Bill, on several occasions to have people that have come in to sing a song or two or play an instrument for even for a little bit, and that really adds to the sense of joy, that peace that's in our environment here as well.
Anderson says they serve up to 50 meals per day, but not everyone can get there to eat.
On a regular basis, we're seeing 40 to 50 people. We do know that some of our volunteers will take some of the leftovers that we have to people that they know that can't make it in because of mobility issues. So, but we can include that in our count as well. So, as I say, 40 to 50 on a regular basis. We have seen 70, but that's an outlier right now, as that's not our regular. That's when we usually have someone special in, like CRA or some other agency that can help people with services.
Alana says loneliness is the epidemic of the 21st century. She says this is important to mention because many desire more than just a meal and clothing.
Simplicity, we say food for the belly and food for the soul, because we all need that companionship. And there's a lot of seniors that are living alone that have lost a loved one. And these are really difficult times as we come into Christmas, when you reflect on the memories of years before. And so by calling it a drop-in center, it's a place where everybody's welcome. We don't ask any question about a need. And sometimes people will try to justify and say, like, or apologize, like, I'm sorry, I don't know if I should be here. And I say, like, you deserve to be here just as much as the next person. Like, it's companionship. And there is no, like, us or them division. We all sit down and we break bread together and build relationships. And that's what community's about. And we're really so fortunate here in Sydney Mines, because there's so many great organizations and we all support one another to work together. We're really lucky to be in the community that we are, to have the relationships that we do.
Alana says even though it's challenging sometimes financially, their success would not be possible without the support of volunteers, many of them recently gathered at the drop-in center to be recognized.
There was 40 volunteers that showed up, so that kind of gives you an idea of our like core crew of volunteers that we have here in Sydney Mines. And it was a combination of volunteers that work in the kitchen, that volunteer in the drop-in center, volunteer in our free mart where we give out the free clothing and hygiene products and shoes and boots and jackets, and our musical volunteers, because we often get musicians that come in and volunteer their time to play, and also pastors from our local churches who come and share a message of hope with us every day.
The drop-in center opened last February. Vince wanted to roll up his sleeves right away to help out. His resume is impressive when it comes to helping others.
Well, you know, I've been volunteering quite a bit all my life, right? Volunteered at Loaves and Fishes for 7 years there, and then moved over to Sydney Mines because my mom was sick. And when she passed away, of course, I couldn't afford to go back to Sydney. So I stayed here and kept praying that we would get something like this here. And when it came, well, I couldn't wait to join, you know, and help any way I can. as far as painting, do scrubbing floors, do doing dishes. It doesn't matter to me, anything at all, just to help out.
Vince fears affordability will get worse for many people.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the prices of everything today, it's just crazy out there. And the other night I was on the kettle, and people's faces are so stressed. It doesn't matter who you are, the prices in the stores are just beyond, right? And it's not getting any better.
Doesn't seem to be.
No. And, of course, they're saying it ain't going to get any better. It's going to go up 5% more on most things. So it's going to be getting worse and worse and worse. Instead of we're hoping that the prices would go down, but they're not going to, you know.
The drop-in center is hosting a Christmas Eve dinner, and Alana says they are expecting to hand out something special to the people who show up for the meal.
December 24th is when we are having our Christmas dinner from 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock. So it will be a turkey dinner. It will be a very special and beautiful dinner where we all eat and enjoy our time together with some live music. But what we are working on right now is we would like to give every single guest that comes through our door on December 24th a stocking stuffer. So a stocking. So we are actively working at filling those stockings now. And so they'll be filled with things like hygiene products. There's been a lot of beautiful knitted hats and mitts, gloves and socks, blankets for the winter for surviving in the cold, hand and feet warmers. Those are all the things that we're filling our stockings with. So we're really hopeful that we'll be able to give each guest a stocking when they come on December 24th.
Souls Harbor Rescue Mission is located at 848 Main Street in Sydney Mines. Regular lunch hours through the week are set for 12 to 2 in the afternoon. If you're running low on cash for a nutritious meal on Boxing Day, or if you're just looking for some company, a traditional gathering continues this year on the North Side. Here's Bill Bradley.
It's the time of year meant to be spent with family and friends, Christmas time, but there's people in our community that don't have that luxury. Eddie Earle's with me right now, and Eddie, this is a venture that was started many, many years ago by yourself and people in the community coming together to give a Christmas meal to people that really couldn't afford it this time of year.
Yeah, it started out as something that for people that couldn't afford, but then I realized there's lots of people can't afford it, but they're by themselves. They've lost a spouse. They don't have any family members living around home. So I figured if we could get a bunch of people together that were in the same boat, that needed company, needed a good meal, or any of the above, that we could do that, it would be a good thing for the community and be a good thing for the people in the community, because then they could make new friends and have a festive meal and enjoy the day, because for some people, Christmas is not an enjoyable time of year.
So you started this how many years ago?
Back in 2011, after I was elected to the House of Assembly, I just wanted to find a way to give back, and thanks to the people who put faith and trust in me to help them. And so I figured, what a better way to give back than provide a good, healthy, hot meal at Christmas time.
This is not just for the North Side. Anybody that feels the need, they want to come in Christmas dinner with all the trimmings, you can go. And it's coming up on Boxing Day, right?
Yes, Boxing Day, the 26th, between 12 and 3. We'll host as many people as want to show up. If we have enough food, we'll feed everybody till we run out or until around 3 o'clock, because it's a long day for everybody. We start early in the morning. We peel the vegetables the day before, and we start early in the morning at the fire hall. Firemen, volunteers, family, friends, and everybody who wants to show up, give a hand, come, and we all pitch in. And by 3 o'clock, we're all pretty tired, and people are fed out, hopefully. So that's good.
So you couldn't do this without the volunteership of the community and for business as well. Let's give a shout out to them.
Well, you know, the Atlantic Superstore stepped up, and they provide all the food, every bit of the food that we need to cook to have that meal, the turkeys, the potatoes, the dressing, the cranberry sauce, the milk, the coffee, the tea, anything that we need for that meal, Superstore provides it. So then I got a bunch of volunteers in the community cook the turkeys, a bunch of volunteers in the community peel the vegetables, a bunch of volunteers come in and help serve, set up the fire hall. But then you got the North City Fire Hall, who donates their hall and all their belongings, and firemen. Without them, we'd never be able to pull this off. So the Superstore and the Fire Hall are the biggest heroes here. We're just the people that help out and add to the experience.
Well, you stated earlier that it was something that you started because you saw the need in the community of people that couldn't afford a meal, but it grew much bigger than that. And people look forward to it each and every year, not just the people that are going, but the people that are actually volunteering. It gives them the sense of belonging in the community.
You know, people just love to give back, and people who are in the community that do a lot of volunteering, they get to see people, and they get to help people, and we all get to talk to people. And it's not just people who can't afford it. It's people, like I say, who have family and friends that are away. No one's going to cook a turkey dinner for themselves, so come along and enjoy a meal with us and not only see old friends, but develop new friends, and hopefully by that it stays that way, and that will make a big difference in our community.
You mentioned volunteers. Of course, always open to volunteers. How can they approach you or somebody to actually volunteer for this big day?
Well, I'm not hard to find. Just get a hold of me or show up at the fire hall. We usually start around 8 o'clock in the morning on Boxing Day in preparing the meal and cooking it and putting it on the table and setting the tables and buttering rolls and so on and so forth. So there's always a job for somebody. And if not, come in and we'll just chat for the couple hours and wait for people to come in and serve. So we always need people to serve because we want to get it out as hot as quick as we can so that everybody can sit down and enjoy the meal together.
And good on you and your family and the people of the North Side for doing this again this year. Merry Christmas.
You too, sir. Merry Christmas to everybody else out there, and hope to see as many faces as we can at the Boxing Day meal on Boxing Day.
Cape Breton University political science professor Tom Urbaniak has written a children's book as a tribute to his late wife, Reverend Allison Etter, who passed away earlier this year, and his two-year-old son, Oliver. The book is written in the four languages familiar to Reverend Etter: English, French, Gaelic, and Polish. We asked Urbaniak to read from a chosen page and describe the illustrations supporting it. The book is called You Are Loved.
The illustration that accompanies the page with the following words: Oliver, your mamusha died on Valentine's Day, 3 days after your birthday. You had just turned 2 years old, but her love continued to flow. And so this shows Allison on a hospital bed. In reality, Allison was hooked up to many things, but this doesn't show that. It shows a peaceful Allison, and Allison was peaceful when she passed away, with sort of hearts trailing out of an open window into a bright daylight. And I just think that's a beautiful illustration. The illustration of the whales on the back cover, I was moved by that when I saw that for the first time. But like, all of these illustrations are just beyond what I had hoped for. It shows Allison providing shelter, visiting Allison as a minister, Allison opening her house to people, Allison setting up a house. Allison, just as an aside, was founding co-chair of the Father Greg McLeod House in Sydney, which provides not only accommodation for students, CBU students from around the world, but is a platform for their work on service to the community.
The book was illustrated by Tammy Krenzicki, who works with digital media.
Tammy is related to members of Warden United Church and Knox United Church in Glace Bay, where Allison served. She lives in Halifax currently, but spends a lot of time in Cape Breton, where her family is. And Tammy recently illustrated another children's book, which was written by her sister, Charlene Graham. And it's about Schooner's Pond, and it's called A Girl, Her Grandma, and the Shore. And I'm so happy that Allison's congregants recommended Tammy. It's been such a pleasure working with her. She's been incredibly patient. We've gone back and forth a lot, trying to capture Allison's spirit, Allison's ideals, and also trying to sort of make the illustrations bold and expressive, and to pass the Oliver test. Our son Oliver, Allison's and my son Oliver, he looked at drafts, and I could sort of get a sense of his reaction to the illustrations, and they certainly passed the Oliver test. And he got the first copy off the press, and he loved it.
Urbaniak hopes the book will give Oliver and the readers a sense of the vision his mother had for a better world.
I try to do my best to communicate to Oliver some of the essence of his mamusha, and that word is used, the Polish word for mom is used even in the English text in the book. And through that, I hope also to maybe generate some conversations about the spiritual and social meaning of Allison's work and Allison's values, because Allison really believed in trying to form communities committed to a different way of being in the world. These are unsettling times. We're in a world dominated by anger, polarization, greed, petty jealousies, violence, outbreaks of war. And that just, the degradation of the planet, growing inequalities, blaming people who are oppressed or marginalized for their own fate. This is not right, and this is not the set of values that Allison would endorse for Oliver or for anyone. So I hope that Oliver sort of gets a sense of the vision that his mom had for a better world, and that other readers get that sense and can talk about it. And maybe one day Oliver will share this with his children as well.
Reverend Etter served congregations in Bedeck, Middle River, Sydney, and Glace Bay. Royalties from the book are going to the Reverend Allison Etter Memorial Fund at the Atlantic School of Theology. Eric McKeegan of Lewisburg lives with spina bifida, but it doesn't hamper his work ethic in creating a unique brand of handcrafted pens, accessories, and countless other pieces of art. His products are intricately designed using resin, historic hand tools, and modern machinery for a process called wood fretting. That's why Eric named his company Fretwood Mac. He likes their music, but it has nothing to do with the popular band. He looks for every opportunity to showcase his work at exhibitions, markets, and even online. Eric's story is as intricate as his art, and he begins by telling Dialogue's Cora Perrigo his unique approach to wood fretting was discovered by accident.
For as long as I've been doing this, the hardest thing for me to do is describe what it is I do. Nothing in my life has ever been simple. Like, I don't know if it's manifestation in my work that, you know, I have to find the complicated way of doing things, or if I just find complicated things to do. The scroll saw stuff, I've been doing that 32 years. You know, I really only started incorporating resin like 8 years ago. That was because I broke something, pretty elaborate piece, and I was like, I worked this far. I need to find a way to fix it. And then from there, it just was like, well, now I have lots of resin left over and it was expensive, so I need to find a way to use it. So then I just started using it in everything. Yeah, it just kind of, you know, grew from there. With the products that I make, I consciously try to make things that are both practical but decorative. I would rather buy something that is not just useful, but, you know, serves some other purpose. What that is, it could be any number of things. Something that serves a purpose, but while you're not using it, if you have friends over or whatever the case is, you can leave it on the counter or on the coffee table or whatever, and it just serves as a conversation piece, because someone else is going to look at it and say, you know, either what is that, mm-hmm. or what is it made from? Like, even when I first started this iteration of business called Fretwood Mac, for the first 3 months I was in business, I did 3 fundraisers. Like, I lost money because I was buying the materials and gave them all my profits. There were people that saw, you know, what I was doing and could appreciate what I was doing. And yes, that did lead to sales that I probably wouldn't have gotten otherwise, because I was reaching someone else's customer base. So had I just, you know, started making things to sell right away and approaching people that I knew, that would have been one thing. But because I reached out through other networks, it certainly expanded, you know, my reach. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Customer satisfaction for me is more important than volume of sales. The sales will come if the customers are happy.
Yeah, how did you get started in it?
So my dad was a carpenter when I was a kid, and he built tables and chairs and, you know, all the things that you would typically think of when you think woodworking. And so I would sit in the workshop, and I would do all the things that a little kid was allowed to do in the workshop. So typically that meant sanding things. I mean, I was having fun because I was a little kid and I was, you know, in the shop with my dad. So that's how I got started in woodworking in general. And then fast forward, you know, my personal history, I was born with spina bifida. I had a hip surgery at 11 years old that caused me to be bedridden for an extended period of time. I was assigned an occupational therapist. She took me to several things that weren't young boy interesting. So like cooking class, there was sewing and a lot of, like I said, a lot of things that weren't interesting to an 11-year-old boy. One day she took me to an older gentleman who had just a brick building in the middle of nowhere. He had a wood shop set up in this brick building, and then he had an RV trailer that was full of the wooden things that he made. And none of them were tables, none of them were chairs, none of them were functional pieces at all. They were all scroll saw projects. I went to see him 2 or 3 weeks with her, and then, you know, being an arrogant little 11-year-old boy, decided that I had learned enough that I could do it.
For 5 minutes. Yeah, I can do this.
Exactly. And so after 3, you know, maybe 4 weeks, I said, all right, I don't need to go back to him, and you've done your job. You know, I've reacclimated to society after bed rest. And so my parents purchased my first scroll saw. Fast forward a bunch of years to my first iteration of a woodworking business of my own was a business I called Wood and Wheels. I bought an old school bus and I took all the seats out and I installed a full woodworking shop in the school bus. My second woodworking business, which is now Fretwood Mac, started in 2013. I, prior to that, had gotten a job as an ambulance dispatcher. I thought I was set. I was now going to make more money than I needed to. I didn't have to do woodworking you know, as a moneymaker anymore. So I got the job in February of 2013 as an ambulance dispatcher. And 3 months later, I started the job. 2 weeks after I started the job, I was at work as an ambulance dispatcher, taking phone calls, and I was still in training, and I looked at my trainer and I said, I don't feel well. And so I wrote it out for a little bit, but then I eventually ended up going home 9 hours into a 12-hour shift, came back the next night, and I went home 3 hours into a 12-hour shift. The third night, less than 3 hours in, I called an ambulance to my own desk, for which we had to explain to the dispatcher it wasn't a training exercise. Inform the dispatcher, yes, this is a real call. Please send an ambulance. The ambulance came to get me, took me to the hospital, and I had some tests done. They let me go. I took a cab back to my work and then drove home, which was about, I don't know, 40-minute drive. Then I got a call from the doctor the next day saying that I had to have what they called emergency brain surgery, but it wasn't immediate. I was having emergency brain surgery in 3 days. 3 days go by, I go in and I have, related to my spina bifida, I have another condition called hydrocephalus, which your brain is surrounded by fluid that causes or keeps it from slamming into your skull. Naturally, it's supposed to drain through your spinal column. Mine is blocked. And so they've installed a plastic tube called a shunt. The shunt that I had at the time collapsed. And so the fluid wasn't draining. And the reason I didn't feel well is because my head was starting to swell, which is why I had to have quote-unquote emergency brain surgery, because they needed to go in and either fix or install a new shunt, which is what they did. They put in a brand new one. It was supposed to be, what did they say? It was supposed to be a 90-minute procedure. After 90 minutes, they came out to the people in the waiting room and said, we're just getting started and things aren't what we expected. It's a bit of a war zone inside his head. There was a lot of scar tissue buildup because turns out they don't actually know when the tube collapsed. Oh. And it could have been those 3 days that I felt bad, or it could have been 5 or 10 years. They have no idea. But what was starting to happen was there was scar tissue where the tube used to be, and the fluid was attempting to drain through the scar tissue, but was being blocked because of how much was built up. 90 minutes in, they come out and say, yep, we're just getting started. The procedure ended up being 6.5 hours. I was then discharged the next day. And so that was from February. I got the job. May, I had the surgery. Was off on medical leave, but because that happened during my probation period of my job, my employer decided not to retain my services, and my contract is not renewed. I'm in sports terms, I'm future endeavored. So they wrote me this, pleasantly worded letter saying, we were glad to have you when we had you. If and when things get better for you, feel free to reapply. And we wish you well in your future endeavors. The welcome back never happened. Reapplying to positions in that field, it's a provincial job, and so even if you move districts or counties, they're all interconnected through the province, and so reference checks happen. So that really has been an ongoing battle that I did and still do have. when I choose to try to get back into that field. And so as a result of losing that job, at the time I was newly married, one income, her income in retail, wasn't going to sustain a household. So Fretwood Mac became kind of a necessity, well, more than a necessity at that time. That's how it got established as my next iteration. So yeah, that is kind of the progression. Got the job in February, had brain surgery in May, lost the job in November, and knew that I couldn't go back, that I needed to do something. And it was something that I could do at my own pace, on my own terms, you know, and not have somebody tell me I was doing it wrong, or I wasn't doing it fast enough, I wasn't, whatever the critique was, whatever the feedback was all mine.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the show, send us an email at news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.